Welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us today. Since last Friday, it's been pretty difficult to turn your attention away from the U.S. southern border. News outlets and analysts were all predicting real chaos would unfold at the border after the Biden administration ended a public health crisis designation that the previous president, Donald Trump, had been using to turn immigrants away during the COVID-19 pandemic. We now know that those concerns were somewhat overblown. There was no appreciable surge of immigrants at the border. There was no chaos that ensued. But while Friday may not have produced the fireworks that many people were awaiting, our guest today might tell you that it's a mistake to think our immigration system doesn't face a real crisis, not just at the border, but also in the courtroom. We all pay a lot of attention to what happens at the border, especially here in Southeast Michigan, where so many people come from Central and South America to our region. But there is another really important part of the immigration system in this country, and that's the court system. It's a body made up of 67 courts and 460 judges, and it processes the hundreds of thousands of cases that involve migrants and their status in this country each year. Now, the vast majority of those cases are deportation cases. And because there are so many of them, it's sometimes easy to gloss over the fact that in each of these cases, you're talking about people. People like you and me. People with families and careers, possessions, all of those things that all of us have in our lives that get put at stake for the folks who are involved in these proceedings. But how is this court system handling such a large number of cases? What do those involved, the attorneys, the migrants, and their families have to say about their experiences in the system? How do we get to a point where such a small number of actors is responsible for such a large number of life-defining cases? And is there a better way to manage the system, both for U.S. citizens and for migrants alike? That's where we want to begin the conversation today, with a discussion about what goes on in immigration courts in this country and how it relates to the stories we hear, the images we see, the tragedies that so often unfold at our southern border. To help answer all of those questions and put it all in context, I'm joined by Maya Barrick. She is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Michigan Dearborn and author of a forthcoming book titled The Slow Violence of Immigration Court. That takes a look at our immigration court system. Professor Barrick, welcome to Detroit Today.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So what do you make first of the concerns about Friday at the border after this Title 42 provision ended and what we ended up with? There were a lot of people who felt like we were going to see a different kind of crisis unfold at the border. It doesn't seem to have materialized.
Yeah, I think what we saw on Friday and, you know, in the few days since is not unusual when it comes to reporting on immigration and the notion that any change in immigration policy is going to lead to a quote-unquote crisis. So with the end of the use of Title 42, which is actually a 1940s public health rule that was brought back into use during COVID, there was this huge concern coming from media, politicians, and perhaps people at the border as well. I don't want to negate those experiences, that there would be a flood. And I use this word flood because this is the kind of imagery that we see in the media, flood, horde of migrants crossing the border, because all of a sudden it was supposedly easier to get into the United States, which it is not. and so there was a lot of hype. And we did not see this surge, wave, flood, horde of people trying to cross into the U.S. because our immigration policy really hasn't changed. The hype, I feel, has done its damage. But these are the types of what I would say, you know, in the book, I talk about slow violence in immigration court. Slow violence meaning the violence that's kind of beneath the surface. It happens slowly over time. If we think about the water crisis right here in Michigan, if we think about exposure to toxic chemicals, that's often how you hear about slow violence. I'm interested in the slow violence of the immigration system, not this hyper-visual sort of spectacular violence that we sometimes see happening at the border or concerns about that violence at the border. So family separation would have been an example of spectacular violence at the border. It was very visible. It was all over the media. But my book and my research is more focused on the inherent violence in the immigration system, particularly in immigration court, which is very mundane. So a very different situation.
Yeah. I want to talk more about the border and what kinds of concerns we should be having about what we do see happening down there. Mm-hmm. But I know that your research and your work is really focused on immigration court, which is another part of the system that I think is hidden from visibility, really, for a lot of Americans. What was it that set you out to conduct this research, speaking directly to migrants and attorneys in the immigration court system?
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason was that the immigration court is really hidden from view. Interestingly enough, these hearings are, for the most part, public. Any one of us could walk into immigration court and sit down and observe a hearing if we so chose to. Of course, there are some limits there, types of cases a judge could ask us to be removed, like in any courtroom. But there's so little that is known about immigration court by the general public, and the court plays such a pivotal role in our immigration system because this is where, as you said during the intro, some of these life-changing decisions are made. People have likened deportation to capital punishment, which is also an area of research that I'm interested in. And so when we think about the gravity of these cases and the fact that just this handful of judges and a handful of courts are processing hundreds of thousands of cases a year. The immigration court right now has a backlog of almost 2 million cases. You think about the webs of families and social networks that are impacted by just one family member going through this experience, or one friend or one coworker. Immigration court really touches millions and millions of people in the U.S. and has these reverberations abroad, right? And so that was what interested me in the court, because it wasn't getting as much attention. And I spent some time as a community organizer doing some immigrant rights work here in Michigan. And I would hear about these stories from the people that I was working with. And I thought it was worthwhile to spend some time really investigating and talking to these folks and creating sort of a way for them to voice their own experiences.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little about some of the people you met during mm-hmm. this research project. Tell me about some of the personal stories that you found really compelling during these interviews.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to, they're all compelling, right? They're all compelling. and it's a difficult subject to research because people aren't very forthcoming with the fact that they're going through a deportation or that they've been deported already and they're back in the United States illegally. Facing another deportation, right? And many times people lived in mixed families. And when I say mixed families, I mean among immigrant families, you usually have family members with varying types of immigration statuses, some who were born in the U.S. and have citizenship, some who came here, maybe have a green card, maybe they've lost their status for some reason. And so people are pretty hush-hush about this because they don't want to harm, they don't want to bring harm upon themselves or their family members. So working with different community networks on the East Coast, which is where I did this research, I was able to connect with people who really opened up and trusted me with these very personal stories. You know, I think there are a number of stories that stand out, but one in particular, I think, captures the immigration experience for a lot of Central Americans mm-hmm. or Central American families that are now living in the United States. A woman from El Salvador who you know, in the 1980s, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, there were various civil wars and conflicts going on in Central American countries, and El Salvador in particular. Her mother left when she was 2 years old, left her with grandparents. This is a common story that we hear, to go to the United States, sort of build a better life, get some resources together, and bring her children to live with her. And the idea was that she would do this. She would seek status. Her mother was able to receive legal status here and was planning to bring her children from El Salvador through the legal channels, right? Applying for visas, waiting in line. This is what we often hear as part of these stories. Why can't people wait in line, right? Why can't they do the proper paperwork, do the background checks to come here instead of just trying to, quote, unquote, come across the border? And her mother went through this process of trying to bring her, and it was just taking years and years and years and years. Meanwhile, the family has been divided. Fast forward, now the daughter is a mother herself. And she sees the situation in El Salvador more recently, which has been dealing with a gang crisis for quite some time at this point, was untenable. So she decides to essentially give up her spot in line, try to come across the border on her own, make a life for her family, and send for her son, whom she left with a grandparent. And we see this cycle happening over and over again.
Yeah, that's a really, I think, important example to lift up, because it gets to the separation of children and parents that we see not only in immigration court, but that we see going on at the border itself. I mean, so much of the border story, I feel like, especially over the last few years, has been about the separation that gets forced on people who are trying to get into this country. And, as you point out in your example, this is not something that happens for a couple of days or a couple of weeks or even months. In many cases, this is essentially a permanent separation of families. Can you talk more about that and why it happens?
Yeah, and I think, this is that slow violence. When we were thinking about family separation over the last few years under the Trump administration, it got a lot of attention in the summer of 2018 if they had actually started this policy of separating parents from their children when they were attempting to come into the United States at the border. And some of those children to this day, a handful of them have yet to be reunited with their parents. And that's, we could talk about that for quite some time, but I'll keep that part brief. That was the spectacular violence that we see that really did capture our attention. There was public outcry and response. How can we do this? How can we separate these families? But as you're pointing out, we are separating families every day, right, in our immigration system. And this separation is happening over extensive periods of time, whether it's one family member is able to come to the United States and has these plans to bring their other members here and cannot, or whether it's you have a family who is well established, an immigrant family here. We think about families in Southeast Michigan. I teach in Dearborn. We have the largest Middle Eastern Arab Muslim populations outside the Middle East. What we saw also during the Trump administration was the targeting of Chaldean communities. We have immigrant families that are well established here, businesses, homeowners, U.S. citizen children. Sometimes those family members had their green card. They never got citizenship. They didn't go through the process to obtain their citizenship. It's not that they couldn't. They just hadn't taken those steps yet. And they didn't feel concerned that they needed to. And then one of those family members, let's say, gets put into deportation proceedings. And most deportation proceedings, the immigration court, most of the cases coming through are deportation hearings, which officially are removal proceedings, but we usually call them deportation hearings. Once you're deported, depending on the circumstances, you may be barred from the United States indefinitely, right? If you've been deported more than once, if you have criminal convictions, various criminal convictions, and even if you don't have this permanent bar, it can be very, very difficult to get back into the United States, to ever obtain a visa or a way to come back, and you are separated from your family indefinitely. And we saw this happening here in our own community within the last few years.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue to talk with Professor Maya Barak of the University of Michigan Dearborn about what's going on in immigration courts and immigration more generally. Also want to get going with you on the phones and on social. Have you or a family member experienced immigration court, or are you someone who has immigrated to, or has your family immigrated to this country? Tell us your story. Why did you come to America, and what has your experience been like with our institutions? Are you someone who has concerns about our borders and the way that people transport themselves across and back and forth? What do you think we should do? How would you adjust our system of immigration? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've joined us. We're talking right now to Maya Barak. She's an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Michigan Dearborn. She's also author of a forthcoming book titled The Slow Violence of Immigration Court, which takes a look at our immigration court system. We are talking about immigration in this country, the problems that we have not only at the border, but also in our courts with the way we deal with people who want to come to this country, the unwelcoming way, I should say, that we deal with many people who seek to be Americans. We want to hear from you as well during the conversation. Give us a call, 313-577-1019. Are you an immigrant to this country? Are you part of a family that immigrated recently to this country? Let us know what that process looked like. Let us know what your interaction with our institutions is like or was like. Also, give us a sense of what you make of our immigration laws and customs here. What would you change? What would you make better than what we have now? 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. I want to read a couple of tweets from the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, which is a really important resource here. The first says, Merck is proud to offer assistance to immigrants who are navigating the complexities of immigration court. They have a help desk program, which you can find on Twitter or at their website, which is michiganimmigrant.org. They continue, in addition to free representation for low-income individuals, Merck is proud to offer assistance to immigrants that are navigating the complexities of that system as well. Another comment on Twitter from Shabadoots says, this issue is so much larger than either party. We need to stop playing politics with the border, stop trying to assign blame across the aisle. We must get to the root of the immigration experience and rebuild the system to meet the modern global reality. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones, and you can go to Twitter to hashtag us, and we can include you in the conversation. Professor Barak, I wonder what you make of the people who sit on the other side, I guess, of this issue and feel that the border is too loose and that immigration law is too loosely enforced, that people come to this country illegally too frequently. What is your experience in immigration court tell you about those sensibilities about our immigration system and whether they're even accurate?
Well, that's such a big and important question mm-hmm. to discuss. you know, when I think about the politics of immigration, that is my 4-month-old in the background during the conversation.
Yes.
When I think about the politics of immigration and how divisive they are, and then you step into immigration court and you observe what's going on and you talk to the people who are going through these experiences, the immigrants and the attorneys, it's not as politically divisive or as straightforward as one might expect. So one of the most interesting aspects of my research, in my opinion, was time and again, what I would hear from the immigrants who I was interviewing, all of whom themselves had been in deportation hearings, were currently in deportation hearings, or were with a family member who was in a deportation hearing, right? So people facing this deportation from the United States, in some cases indefinitely. And I would ask them about fairness. I'm really interested in how people think about fairness.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, is the immigration court system fair? You know, what's your experience here? The lawyers, the attorneys, they had a lot to say about fairness from that insider perspective and what the law should be in their minds. For the immigrants, time and again, people would say, I came to the United States because this is a country where the rule of law exists.
Mm.
I'm leaving chaos in my home country. I'm leaving corruption. I'm leaving violence. When I think of the United States, it is a place of justice. This is what brought me here. And people felt that to have even their day in court, that they were being treated fairly and with respect. They were very impressed by our legal system. And one might ask the question, well, why is it then that they, in many cases, were in the U.S. violating the law,
mm-hmm.
right, in violation of the law? Because it seems contradictory to say, oh, I came to the U.S. because there's the rule of law, and I know the law is enforced in the U.S., but I broke the law to get in. I think that's that tension, that conflict that I found really interesting. And again, it's because these are people who are leaving chaotic situations. They want the law to be enforced. And in fact, and I've done some other research with some colleagues, Dr. Lowry Kinberg and Dr. Mellinger, where we were talking about policing and enforcement with immigrants in South Florida, asking some similar questions about fairness. And these folks would say, I love in the U.S. that the law is enforced. The police are here to do their jobs. The court system works. People who commit crimes should be punished. Immigrants who commit crimes should be deported. This is what I'm hearing from them. So I don't, you know, I think that that challenges us to reframe the way we talk about immigration and this divide left and right, you know, enforcement versus open borders, that these dichotomies are really superficial.
Yeah.
Right. We can, when we start to unpack things, it becomes a bit more complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. I also want to talk just a little about the difference between the way migrants feel about the courts and the court system and the way attorneys feel about it. You talked to both in your research, and they reported really vastly different experiences. What was that difference?
Yeah. And I think, you know, when we think about an attorney, we think about someone who, if you're going into law, it's because you care about the law, right? For the most part. It's because you believe in the law and you're socialized through school, through law school, and then through the legal profession in a way that is going to shape, right, how you view the court, in this case, the immigration court. And so the attorneys I spoke to were very concerned about issues of procedural justice and due process. Procedural justice being process fairness. How are people being treated in court? Is there a bias on the part of the judges or the ICE attorneys who are akin to a prosecutor in the immigration court system, but not quite the same? And whether or not the law is really being followed. Are immigrants' rights being violated? And so for attorneys, they had many instances that they could recount. And I spoke to attorneys, some who have been practicing for a short time, some who have been practicing for decades and have seen lots of different immigration reforms. And they had a lot of concerns about the violation of immigrants' rights, due process protections, which are limited in immigration court, which is the civil court, as compared to the due process rights that we all have in the criminal system. And they were concerned with the treatment of immigrants. And one example, a simple example, is language. Right. So most immigration court proceedings are taking place with translators, mm-hmm. with the aid of translators, because most immigrants are coming from countries where English is not the primary language, and many immigrants have, you know, English as a second language or are limited proficiency with English. And so they have the aid of interpreters. And there is a right to interpretation in immigration court in order to protect the folks who are going through this experience. And you can imagine, it's scary enough when you have to go to traffic court for a ticket in some cases, in a country where you've grown up, a legal system you're familiar with, and a language that you likely are pretty comfortable in. Imagine being someone from a foreign country, and these proceedings are happening in another language. And you may or may not have an attorney, because in immigration court, you have a right to hire your own attorney, mm-hmm. but an attorney will not be provided for you. So immigration attorneys gave me lots of examples, for instance, where they saw immigrants' rights being violated when it came to having the appropriate translation, the appropriate language for the immigrant there. That's just one example. But again, for the immigrants I spoke to, this is the fact that I'm here in court, that the judge is not taking, you know, isn't getting any kickbacks, that the attorneys are not corrupt, that people are listening to me. Wow. That's incredible. For the immigration attorneys, they would say, well, perhaps it's because the immigrants aren't as familiar with our legal system and they don't recognize that their rights are being violated. But again, I don't want to negate people's experiences. I think it's very powerful when we think about immigration reform and what that means to hear from immigrants about the system itself.
Yeah, yeah. What would you say to conservatives who are really skeptical of immigration, who have, I think, put themselves in, in an extreme position in reaction to the idea of immigration? Certainly their political leaders are now mm-hmm. much, much more against immigration than they were 20 or 25 years ago. What's the argument to them about what you see in your research that suggests this is not the threat to the country that they think it is, but also that it has great promise for America?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's funny, when I talk about this in the classroom, sometimes I'll get a response from students and they'll listen to my research or they'll listen to our lectures, our discussions, and they'll say, well, you support illegal immigration. You just want more illegal immigration. And they say, no, not at all. Right? And they say, well, then you want open borders. And I say, no, we don't have to go that far either. Right now, what we're doing is throwing hundreds of billions of dollars into a system of enforcement that isn't really working. Right? Not only that, we've started pulling resources from the parts of the immigration system that process visas, for example, mm-hmm. right? So again, when we hear that narrative, people should get in line, or I did this the right way, you should too. You should have to go through a process with background checks where you're submitting these applications and you wait your turn. Well, we've shrunken our capacity to process visa applications and bring people to the country through these legal channels. People are waiting, people who qualify for visas, right? Different kinds of visas, whether through family or people who are waiting for a work visa. We are putting these folks in lines that in some cases are spanning decades. And so as they sit and wait, and perhaps situations in their home country become more tenuous, or their families are living in the U.S. and growing without them, it sort of starts to tip the scales and they think, well, maybe I'll try to come across without permission. Yeah. Maybe I'll try to cross the border, which then has sort of led to this expansion of these illegal networks of smuggling, which is at this point controlled in large part by organized crime. People are spending thousands upon thousands of dollars paying into criminal networks to try to get into the country, right? So we're creating more crime. And then once folks are here, if they don't have a status, if they do anything, if they work, if they drive, all of a sudden they're committing crimes themselves and they're vulnerable to exploitation. Right? They're in a precarious position because if I'm concerned, if I'm experiencing domestic violence, but I don't have legal status, I'm afraid to go to the police and report that. If I'm being underpaid at work, if I'm being exploited at work, I'm afraid to report that, right? Someone could, in many cases, extort money from me. These are things that happen, and people don't report those crimes. So we're sort of shrinking our capacity and our ability to let people come into the country with vetting with background checks, right, through these proper channels, as folks say, and then we're creating more crime. Yeah. That's what the criminologist in me when I look at these issues, because we're funneling people through these illegal networks on the border. This is funneling money into organized crime. We're creating a vulnerable population within the U.S. that's susceptible to crime, right? So when we're thinking about the issues that we tend to say conservatives are more concerned with, crime and crime control when it comes to the border, border enforcement, I would say, wouldn't it be nice to know who's coming into the country and what they're doing when they're here, mm-hmm. right? And then we can keep tabs and keep track, not in a scary Big Brother way, but we can know what's going on as opposed to pushing this under the surface and into the shadows, right? And then we're also, in that sense, if we make it a faster process, a more efficient process, and a more effective process for folks to come in through legal channels, then we're going to shrink that pool of money that's going to these organized criminal networks, and we're going to shrink that pool of vulnerable folks who could be susceptible to crime. So it's actually more, we'll have more effective crime control if we stop throwing a wrench in legal immigration.
And, you know, I mean, it kind of gets back to what the actual objections really are to immigration. I mean, everything you said is a very logical argument about why a more humane approach to the idea of immigration would actually result in better outcomes, not just for immigrants, but also for people who live in this country. And yet you can't even have that conversation with so many people. And you know, look, it does come down to, in many cases, what countries these migrants are coming from and what people in this country have come to believe about people from Central and South America and race, ethnic background. It really confounds the kind of logical argument that or discussion that we might have about all of these things. I want to go quickly to the phones before we have to end the segment. Glenn in LaSalle Park. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Stephen, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to say we had our stepdaughter had a woman that was a transgender, and she was threatened to be killed, and her mom called her at work and said, you have to leave the country. She left the country, came up eventually, I don't know how, got through Mexico and came in, and my stepdaughter volunteered to take care of her from Texas to bring her up here, and I experienced some of the times she went to court. It was so well organized, and there was so much support. I mean, it was really, really, really busy, but it just was, you know, everybody was pulling in the same direction. And she's got a permit to work now, and, you know, just to be a real advantage as a person in this country. And I just thought that aspect in our experience was excellent.
So what country did this person immigrate from? Glenn,
she was El Salvador.
Okay, and she made her way from there into Mexico and then into the United States.
Exactly, and I don't really know the story how. I just can't imagine. And she's transgender, and you know, that was the reason they just couldn't. I mean, they couldn't live with that. I guess whatever. And so she was threatened, and she came here. And
did she get refugee status here, or did she just come into the country? Do you know?
She came in, and yeah, she must have gotten refugee status because my daughter volunteered to take a refugee.
I see.
To support them, and there were certain things we had to do for them. And, you know, she learned English and became, you know, was able to stay in this country and is now working and, you know, having a life of her own here.
Yeah. Glenn, I really appreciate the call and the example. Professor Barrick, I want to give you a chance to react before we have to end the segment.
Yeah, what a great call, Glenn. Thank you for bringing that up. And that's when we see the immigration system working. But that, she's very fortunate. It's wonderful that this has worked out for her because that's pretty rare. It sounds like she probably qualified for a type of for asylum, mm-hmm. which is very difficult to do. So when someone comes to the U.S., if they have a credible fear, that's a legal term, a credible fear of returning to their home country, that fear gets vetted, and then you may be able to stay in the U.S. And there are some other similar circumstances that allow folks for various reasons to stay in the U.S. under these special statuses. But for that to happen, there are so many hurdles and barriers. Not only is it difficult to make that journey into the United States, not knowing what might happen to you along the way, right? There's a lot of violence that folks experience as they're trying to cross make their way to the United States and cross the border. Of course, then people are apprehended at the border and they go into our immigration system. They're often detained for long periods of time before their hearing will happen. And many of our detention facilities in the U.S., the immigration detention facilities, are actually contracted out to jails and prisons. So they're housed in facilities that were for people who are being punished for committing a crime, right? The conditions are not great. Mm-hmm. And then if you're able to obtain an attorney, you have a much better shot in the court system. But again, you have to pay for that attorney yourself or find a pro bono attorney, which can be very difficult because think about that backlog. Almost 2 million cases, 2 million people waiting for their hearing, yeah. Right? But once they get to the court, if the court has the resources, right, and the court has the time, we could start processing these cases and we could get people the outcomes that legally they are owed, whether they are eligible for status or in the end they may not be, which many people are not. And under our current system would end up deported. But without those resources for the court, it's very difficult to see this happen.
Okay. Maya Barak, Associate Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. It was really great to have you here, and we look forward to your forthcoming book, The Slow Violence of Immigration Court. Thanks so much for joining us on Detroit Today. We're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we are going to talk with the youngest member of the Detroit City Council, Gabriela Santiago Romero, who represents District 6, which includes Corktown and Southwest and Midtown. We'll talk about all the things that are going on in that really interesting and diverse part of the city. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.